All right, then should we get started? Welcome. It's really nice to see this many people here, and Digitree and Free Software Foundation Europe are proud to present Richard Stallman, founder of the GNU project. Today he'll be speaking on the subject of copyright versus community in the age of computer network. Please give him a warm welcome.
Is this mic working? Okay, that's good. Please raise your hands if you cannot hear me. I guess people can hear me. See, it always works. So, the reason people started asking me to give speeches was because of my work in the free software movement and developing the GNU operating system, which most people have mistakenly come to think of as Linux. You don't hear so much about free software nowadays. And the reason is that lots of people decided not to even mention the term free software, and they talk about open source instead. Now, there's a big difference between free software and open source, a big difference at the level of philosophy. You see, free software is a movement for human rights for software users. We believe that every software user is entitled to four essential freedoms. Freedom zero is the freedom to run the program as you wish. Freedom one is the freedom to study the source code of the program and change it so that it does what you wish. Freedom two is the freedom to help your neighbor. That's the freedom to distribute copies of the program to others when you wish. And freedom three is the freedom to contribute to your community, which is the freedom to distribute copies of your modified versions when you wish. If a program gives you all four of these freedoms, it's free software, which means the social system of its distribution and use is an ethical system respecting the user's freedom. But if one of these freedoms is missing, then the program is proprietary software, user-subjugating software, non-free software, which means that the social system of its distribution and use does not respect your freedom. So a proprietary program imposes on the users the power of the developer. The developer keeps the users divided and helpless. And this is an injustice that we in the free software movement hope to put an end to. Now, talking about right and wrong makes a lot of businesses uncomfortable. They don't want their actions to be judged by any ethical standard. They want their actions to be judged only in terms of profit. When they offer something to the public, they don't want the public to ask themselves, does this respect my freedom? They want the public to think of it only in terms of what job can I do with it and how much does it cost? They want to deal with consumers, not with citizens. So those companies don't like talking about free software, and they have another term, open source, which they use instead. It's a way that they can avoid raising the ethical issues of the free software movement. And because of that, these ethical ideas now have to struggle to be heard. But they are sometimes heard. And I think the number of people aware of them is increasing, thanks sometimes to the help of some of you here. So, as the free software of the GNU plus Linux operating system came to be known, and as people started to hear about these free software packages, even if they don't know about free software, they started inviting me to give more speeches about the ideas of the free software movement and GNU. And sometimes at the end of a speech, someone would ask, well, do these ideas apply to anything else? How about computers or microphones or tables and chairs or cars? Now, that's a smart aleck question. It's a silly question because it's really just inviting people to misunderstand it. Because he didn't really mean the same definition of free. Let's try seeing whether the same question makes sense for physical objects, like, say, cars or chairs. Well, what does it mean for something to be free? It means the users have the four freedoms. Well, freedom zero is the freedom to run the program. Well, that would be the freedom to use the object. If it's yours, you're free to use it normally. And what about freedom one, the freedom to study the source code and change it to make the program do what you wish? Well, there's no source code for physical objects in general. There might be plans, but that's not the same thing. There's nothing to automatically compile the plans into the object. Now, you can study and modify the object itself to a certain extent, more or less depending on what it is. If it's a car, there are a lot of things you could do to it. If it's a chip, you can't modify it at all. To modify a chip destroys it. No one can do that. So, well, that freedom you have more or less as much as it's physically feasible. What about freedom two, the freedom to make copies and distribute them to others? Well, there are no copiers, so that's a moot point. It's a meaningless question. And likewise, freedom three, the freedom to copy and distribute your modified versions. Again, there are no copiers, so you can't do that. There's no way to do that. If you wanted more of them, you'd have to build them one by one and modify them. So the answer is physical objects are as free as they could be, given the limits of the physical world and our technology as it is today. So that smart aleck question doesn't really mean anything. But there are other things for which it is a meaningful question, namely other kinds of works made out of information that you might have in your computer. Those can be copied. Those can be modified. And so it's meaningful to ask, to what extent should people have the freedom to do it? It's a meaningful question. Now, if you have a work other than a program, then in general, the only thing that's going to limit your freedom to do any of those things is copyright law. Programs are a special case. They're often restricted by end-user license agreements, which are contracts. But other kinds of works usually are just covered by copyright law. So to ask what freedoms we should have in using published works is another way of asking what copyright law should say about them. Now, people who have raised copyright issues with you before have probably got the question totally confused by equating copyright to, quote, intellectual property, unquote. In order to prevent that term from confusing the issue, I want to explain why it's confused. That term literally refers to copyright law and a bunch of other laws which are totally different from each other, which do different things in different areas and are different in just about every point. They have almost nothing in common. And as a result, when people think that they're all instances of the same thing, they're confused already. People who think, for instance, that copyright law and patent law are similar are totally confused, can't possibly understand copyright law or patent law, because really they're almost completely different. And then trademark law is even more different. So if you think that copyright law and patent law and trademark law are three different instances of this one, three different species of the same genus, you'll never understand. And lawyers and people who want to intimidate you know how useful that term is for confusing people. It's no accident that Microsoft frequently brings up that term, that the movie companies and record companies love to use that term. And they're talking about various different things all the time, but you'd never guess that, because they make it sound like it's the same thing. And the point is, they don't want people to think clearly about copyright law or about patent law or about trademark law. To think clearly about them starts from keeping them separate. They're separate subjects with nothing to do with each other. And then you can learn about each one, and you can come to understand each of these laws which you're interested in, and think carefully about it. To think carefully about them, we have to avoid mixing them up. In general, if someone uses the term, quote, intellectual property, unquote, either he's confused or he's trying to confuse you. So in this talk, I'm talking about copyright law, which is a law restricting the use of a particular work of authorship. Specifically, restricting the details of the expression of that work, not the ideas. The ideas are not copyrightable. Anybody can write an algebra book, and it's not considered to be copying from another algebra book. It's not copyright infringement, because copyright doesn't cover ideas like that. It only covers the way the subject is expressed in one particular textbook. That's not true of patent law. Patent law is totally different. So, the question that people asked me can be expressed as, what should copyright say about other kinds of works? Now, in order to think about copyright law, it's useful to look at its history. And the history of copyright law is closely connected with the history of copying technology. And we need to think about copying technology in order to think about what copyright law should say. Now, changes in technology can't affect basic moral principles, which are too deep for technology to reach. But when we apply our principles to a specific question, we do it by looking at the consequences of the various choices we could make. And those consequences can be changed by the context. For instance, suppose we could resurrect the dead. Then killing somebody wouldn't be so bad. You just say, well, you killed him, you have to pay for his new body. Right? It wouldn't be a big deal. So let's look at the history of copying technology and the history of copyright law that is developed with it. Copying began in the ancient world, where it was done with a writing instrument. You would read one copy and you'd write another. That was the first technology for copying things. Now, this technology had certain consequences. First of all, it didn't require any special skill beyond the skill to read and write. Anyone who could read and write could copy more or less as efficiently as anyone else. Second, it didn't require any special equipment beyond that needed to read and write. Third, it had no economy of scale. To make 10 copies took 10 times as long as making one copy. So the result was that people just made copies one at a time wherever they wanted one. If you had one copy of a book and you wanted another, you'd copy it. As far as I can tell, there was no such thing as copyright in the ancient world. Anyone who had a book and wanted to copy it was free to do so, unless the king didn't like that book, and then maybe he'd execute you. However, there was a big advance in copying technology, the printing press. The printing press was a big advance because it made copying more efficient, but not uniformly so. Some kinds of copying became a lot more efficient, and others were not affected. The reason is that the printing press has an inherent economy of scale. It takes a lot of work to set the type. But once you've done that, you can make many identical copies efficiently. Furthermore, the printing press and the type were expensive specialized equipment that most readers didn't have and didn't know how to use. The result was a centralized system for copying. The copies of any particular book were made in a few places and then transported from there to the people who wanted to read them. For the first few centuries of printing, it was still quite common for people to copy books by hand. This was generally done either for rich people to show how rich they were, or by poor people. As the song goes, time ain't money if all you got is time. So, hand copying continued, but most of the copies were made by printing after that point. Copyright developed in the age of the printing press. The oldest copyright systems I know of, anything like copyright, started around 1500. In Italy, it became common that if you wrote a book, you could ask a prince to give you a monopoly on printing it. Princes like to give out monopolies over all sorts of things as rewards for some kind of support. So if you said in the front of the book that this prince was really wonderful, then he'd probably give you a monopoly over printing it. The current copyright system, I believe, came out of England, but the first copyright system in England was actually a system of censorship in the 1500s. In order to be able to print anything, one had to get a copyright, a permission from the government to print that book. And this was in the form of a monopoly given to a particular printer, a perpetual monopoly. The system of censorship became obsolete around 1700. So England adopted a different copyright law that gave the monopoly to the author temporarily. And people began to think of this as a system to promote writing. When the U.S. Constitution was written, there was a suggestion that authors should be entitled to a copyright. Now, you'd never believe this listening to the movie companies and so on, but in fact, that suggestion was rejected. And instead, the U.S. Constitution adopted a different idea, which is that copyright is an optional system for promoting authorship by giving authors temporary monopolies. Congress could set up such a system if it wished, but it was not required. And if they did so, the purpose was explicitly stated as to promote progress. Now, copyright in the age of the printing press functioned as an industrial regulation because it restricted publishers. It didn't restrict ordinary readers because it didn't restrict the things ordinary readers could do. Ordinary readers did copy by hand, but nobody ever tried to accuse them of copyright infringement because copyright was understood as an industrial regulation. And in fact, for the most part, it didn't even forbid copying by hand. So, because it was an industrial regulation, it was also easy to enforce, pretty much uncontroversial, and arguably beneficial for the public. It was easy to enforce because it only had to be enforced against publishers, and it's easy to see who's publishing a book. You look and you find copies on sale and you say, where did these come from? You don't have to invade everybody's home or everybody's computer. It was pretty much uncontroversial because the readers not being restricted in the things that they could feasibly do, they had no reason to complain. And it was arguably beneficial because the public exchanged a freedom that it didn't have the capacity to exercise, and in exchange got more writing. So more writing is a good thing, and the public didn't lose anything. If you have something that's valueless to you and you sell it, and in exchange you get something that's good, it's a good deal. So the copyright bargain, as it was known, was probably good for the public in the age of the printing press. Now, around 1900, printing presses became a lot more efficient, and printed books became a lot cheaper. I think that's when paperback books began. And the result was that even poor people, if they knew how to read and write, could buy printed copies. They didn't have to copy by hand anymore. And so the idea that lots of people would actually copy by hand was forgotten. But nonetheless, copyright was still treated as an industrial regulation, and people didn't face threats of prosecution if they copied a book by hand once in a while. However, the age of the printing press is giving way to the age of the computer networks, another advance in the efficiency of copying. And like the previous one, it's not uniform. Computer technology makes copying more efficient, but its biggest effect is on one-at-a-time copying. It brings us to a situation almost like the ancient world, in which one-at-a-time copying is almost as cheap as mass production copying. Now, it's true that there's still a certain amount of advantage for mass production. For instance, mass-produced CDs are somewhat cheaper than one-off CDs and more durable. But nonetheless, writing CDs one by one is cheap enough that hundreds of millions of people do it. So we're now back in a situation like the ancient world, where anybody who has a copy of a work in her computer can feasibly copy it and also do other things with it. This is what makes digital information technology so useful. It facilitates copying and manipulating information. But not everybody wants this to be easy for us. The publishers, for decades, used to say, digital technology creates problems for copyright law. And this shows how backwards their ideas were. I would say copyright law creates problems for the use of digital technology. So it's a matter of where your priorities are. Is your priority how to restrict people, or is your priority how to enable them to do things? And the result of this technological change is to change the implication of copyright law. The same law, which in the age of the printing press was an industrial regulation imposed on publishers, controlled by authors for the sake of the public benefit, turned into a restriction on the general public in the name of the authors, but actually wielded by the publishers. Completely backwards. That's what a change in technological context can do to a law. So even if copyright law had remained unchanged, the law that was probably a good thing in the age of the printing press would be a bad thing now. So what would democratic governments do in a situation like this? Well, if they have been selling our freedom on our behalf to get something for us, and now, and we used to be content with that because we couldn't exercise that freedom anyway, but now we can exercise it, and now we want to exercise it, what the governments would do on our behalf is they would say, we can't continue this deal, not in its past form. We've got to reduce it. The public, the citizens want to keep some of this freedom and exercise it. So I'm sorry, you can't buy as much freedom from them. We're going to have to renegotiate the deal and make it smaller. You can measure how undemocratic our governments are by their tendency to do the exact opposite. Since in the past few decades, in the same time that we have seen the burgeoning of digital information technology, we've seen copyright extended in unprecedented ways. First, there's the dimension of time. How long does copyright last? It's been extended over and over. And for instance, in the United States, in 1998, they extended copyright by 20 years on old works as well as works yet to be written. Now, they didn't try to explain how 20 more years of copyright for the works written by the dead authors of the 1920s would retroactively convince them to write more back then. Now, you could imagine that the authors of today, knowing that copyright has just been extended for 20 more years of their grandchildren's or great-grandchildren's lives, might do more writing. But any business that wants to claim that it needed 95 years of copyright instead of 75 has to justify that claim by showing its projected balance sheets for 75 years in the future. Of course, there's no business in the world that looks that far ahead. We know the real reason for that law. The reason was that the copyright on the movie Steamboat Willie, in which Mickey Mouse first appeared as a character, was going to expire. And Disney didn't want that to happen. So Disney paid for, and others, of course, paid for a law to extend the copyright by 20 more years. The movie companies in the U.S. say they want perpetual copyright. but the U.S. Constitution won't let them get that. So they came up with a scheme to get the same result, which is perpetual copyright on the installment plan. Here's how it works. Every 20 years, they will extend copyright by 20 more years, if they can. We failed to stop them in 1998. In another 11 years or so, we're going to have to fight them again. Maybe that time, we'll be able to stop them. But democracy is pretty sick nowadays. It's not going to be easy for the people to prevail over wealthy, powerful companies. So that's one dimension of copyright law, how long copyright lasts. Much too long. The other dimension that has been extended is what copyright covers. See, in the past, copyright was never supposed to cover all the uses of a copyrighted work. The uses covered by copyright were an exception within a broader space of unregulated uses. But in recent decades, the copyright-owning businesses have been pushing that, trying to grab total power. They want a world in which they do control all use of a published copyrighted work. And they first achieved that in the United States in 1998 with the passage of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, a law that authorized publishers to write their own copyright rules by implementing them in code. What that law said was that if the work was published encrypted, such that only certain authorized players could access it. In other words, if the work carried Digital Restrictions Management, DRM, then anything that enabled the public to escape from these restrictions was forbidden, censored. And thus, it became illegal in the US to distribute the free software to play a DVD. This free software was developed by a few people in Europe, the only one whose identity is known being DVD John. And it's censored in the US. To distribute copies of it is a crime. But there are countries in Europe now which have even nastier laws. In France, just to possess a copy is a crime. You see, when the United States has a problem, it doesn't try to correct this problem. Instead, it tries to impose the problem on the rest of the world. So, what we see is a very broad-based power grab in across all media, an attempt to take away the rights that of the public in using copyrighted works, the rights we used to have in the age of the printing press. Just the opposite of what governments ought to be doing. For instance, if music, there are things that look like compact discs, but they're not real compact discs because they don't follow the format. They don't follow the standard for a compact disc. And in many European countries, they're not allowed to call them compact discs. Instead, they have a different symbol that warns you that it's a corrupt disc designed for digital restrictions management. And they say on them, you can play this in Windows and Macintosh systems, meaning you need proprietary software to play this disc. And a couple of times, people who had invited me to give speeches gave me recorded music that they thought I'd like to listen to. And I saw this symbol and I said, thank you, but I can't accept this. Please bring it back to the store because they shouldn't be able to keep your money. And I never heard those records because I'm not willing to buy or even accept as a gift a product that is afflicted with digital restrictions management. Now, the nastiest example of these corrupt discs was actually done by Sony. A couple of years ago, this was discovered. Sony had produced these music recordings that had rootkits on them. They would install software into the operating system, which would then try to disguise its presence so that the user couldn't see it, and did other things to impede removal of that software. And it also damaged the security of the computer while it was at it. And if that wasn't bad enough, it also contained GPL-covered free software that had been copied illegally. So, in addition to setting out just to restrict the listeners, Sony did just about every other nasty thing you could imagine doing to people's computer systems, and so there was a lot of anger and upset. But it was mostly directed at the other things. So eventually, Sony promised that they would never do those other things in the future when they try to restrict the users. And they've learned their lesson, all right. In the future, the rootkit will be built into the computer system before you get it, and it will be absolutely impossible to remove. There is a new DRM conspiracy called AACS, or the AXE. And this is what's used in HD DVD and Blu-ray discs, which is why people are boycotting those. You should never buy a product with DRM unless you have the means to break the DRM. So, AACS is a DRM conspiracy. That means that there are several companies, I think there are eight of them, that have worked together to set up the conspiracy. Then anyone who wants to make discs or players has to sign a contract where they promise that they will keep the format secret and that they will restrict the users, all of them, according to the rules of the conspiracy. And one notable rule that I remember in the AACS conspiracy is that after a certain year, I think it's 2011, the manufacturers are not allowed to make analog video outputs anymore. They have to get rid of them completely. That's just one of the rules for controlling the public that this conspiracy imposes on everyone making authorized equipment. Now, you might ask, how do I know about this conspiracy? How can I be sure? I'm completely sure because they have a website and they say exactly which companies they are. I think it includes Intel and Microsoft and Sony and Philips and a bunch of others. Now, I'm happy to say that the encryption scheme was broken. And a few weeks ago, people found the crucial number that was necessary to finally decode these HD DVD discs, and they posted it on a website, and the people running the website took it down, and it was posted again and again and again, hundreds of times. It was posted on 700,000 different websites within a couple of days. So it was the example for a big outburst of disgust for DRM. I'm really happy to see the public show its hatred for DRM. But that doesn't mean we've won the war. So we can also, of course, find DRM in the area of video. These same DVDs and also these newer discs, which are designed to restrict the public. And we could also see it for books. The book publishers would like to take away traditional freedoms of readers, such as the freedom to borrow a book from the public library, or sell it to a used bookstore, or lend it to a friend, or buy it anonymously by paying cash, and even the freedom to keep the book for as many years as you like and read it as many times as you like and maybe pass it on to your children who might read it themselves. They want to get rid of all that. But they think that they can't manage to get rid of all that explicitly, because there are too many people who read books and want their freedom and might get angry. So they came up with a two-stage plan to get rid of these freedoms. The first stage was take away these freedoms for e-books. And that they do with laws like the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and the EU Copyright Directive, which allow them to publish encrypted e-books and forbid the distribution of free software that can access them. The second stage is to convince people to switch from printed books to e-books. And we saw a big hype campaign several years ago trying to get people to all start using e-books. One publisher thought that the best way to start off their line of e-books to convince all the geeks to buy e-books was to publish my biography as an e-book. So they made a deal with a writer and sent him to me, and he asked if I would cooperate. And I said, sure, I'll cooperate, provided my biography is not encrypted and doesn't restrict people. I just love it when I have a chance in my own life to stand up for the same principles that I speak in favor of all the time. So he went back to the publisher, who rejected this. So then I suggested he could try another publisher, who agreed, and the book was published, and it's called Free as in Freedom. Now, I know there was an organized campaign trying to make everybody use e-books. And the reason is, in 2001 or so, I was in a domestic flight in Brazil, and I looked in the in-flight magazine, which was in Portuguese and English, and in the place where a real magazine would have an editorial, it had something that looked like one, but it was speculating about precisely how many years it would take before we were all reading e-books. Now, nothing ever gets published in those magazines except because the airline expects to make money from it. And since this article was not talking about a travel destination, they must have been paid. So this, I think, is proof that there was an organized campaign of trying to brainwash everybody to use e-books, but it didn't work. However, I don't think that the failure was because people value their freedom too much. I think that people probably didn't like it for some practical convenience reason, which means that they'll be back trying again with some other variation. we shouldn't think that we're safe. So for all these media, we see a power grab. But what should our governments do? What would democratic governments do? So what should we do to copyright law? Well, governments were trading away too much of our freedom. What they should do is reduce the scope of this trade. Maybe not all the way to zero, but less than it was before. So the first question is, what about the length of time of copyright? Over the same half century where copyright's been extended and extended, the publication cycle has been getting faster and faster. I don't know about Sweden, but in the US, most books are remaindered within 2 years and out of print within three. So there's no, and the same is true of other media. So there's no need for 150 years of copyright. I suggest that copyright should last for 10 years starting from the date of publication. Now, there's no harm letting the author have as long as she wants to get the book published or the work published. We're not losing anything if we're not allowed to make copies while we don't have any copies. So there's no harm saying the copyright begins from the date of publication and then lasts for 10 years. I suggest this as a first step. After we change it to 10 years, we can then wait a while and see how it's going, and then we could make it shorter or longer based on what we see. I proposed this once on a panel discussion with writers. I expected some fireworks and I got some. The award-winning fantasy writer sitting next to me said, 10 years, that's out of the question. Anything more than 5 years is intolerable. I was surprised too. I naively assumed that when the entertainment companies said that the authors needed more copyright power, that they were telling the truth. When they want more power, they say they're doing it on behalf of the creators. That word almost makes them sound like gods. They deserve special power over mere mortals, right? But in fact, these same companies that demand more power over everybody in the name of writers are grinding those writers and artists into the ground with their heels. This writer had a dispute with his publisher. His contract had a standard clause in it, which said that when the book went out of print, the rights would revert to him. Well, his book appeared to be out of print for all he could tell, but the publisher wouldn't admit it. So he had to get into a legal dispute with his publisher just to get the right to distribute copies of his own book so that people could read them. And he knew that more than 5 years of copyright was not going to do him any good. It was only going to give the publisher a chance to shaft him. So, well, I propose 10 years as a first cut at making copyright a reasonable length of time. But there's also the dimension of what copyright should cover. And to state my recommendations about this, I want to divide works into three different categories. I don't think that the answer should be uniform. I don't think we should treat all works the same. And by the way, copyright doesn't treat all works the same now. Copyright laws are not uniform across the board. So since we're talking about making a deal, a trade, we don't have to make the same deal for everything. We can divide works up into categories, and for each category, make the deal that we, the public, think is best. So here are my three categories. First, there are the works of practical use, the works whose contribution to society is that people use them to do practical jobs. Second, the works that say what certain parties think. And third, the works of art and entertainment, whose contribution to society is in the impact they make. For each of these categories, I have a different recommendation based on the way society uses the work. First, the works of practical use, functional works, knowledge works. These include software and recipes and educational works and reference works and text fonts and surely other things as well. These should all be free and all for the same reason. Because you use these works to do jobs in your life. If you can't control these works, you can't control the job. So you've got to be free to change the works that you use in order to control your own life. But once you change them, you've got to be free to publish your modified work as well, because there are going to be other people who have the same needs or preferences as yours. So once you've made the work better for you, you should be able to publish it so it's available also to all the others who want the same thing you want, who want to do the job the same way you want to do it. So this means you've got to have freedom one and three. The freedom to study it and change it and then publish your modified version. Well, what about freedom two, which is the freedom to redistribute or republish without changes? How much change does it take before something is a modified version? It could be epsilontically small. There, you know, the limit, it goes to zero. So it doesn't make any sense to permit publication of modified versions and not permit republication without change. You could always add something that explains why you wanted to republish it, and now it's modified, right? So we really have to have all four freedoms. There's no way for anything less to be sufficient. Now, people might ask, if you don't have restrictions on the users as a tool to extract money from them, will these works be produced? 25 years ago, nobody knew the answer to that. But now, we have the example of the free software community showing the answer is yes. And of course, there are all the recipes that are circulating through society showing that the answer is yes. And then there is Wikipedia. And we're starting to have free textbooks, and we're starting to have free text fonts too. So we see that these works of practical use will be produced. There's no need for us to accept chains on us just in order to have practical works for us to use. But what about the other categories? The second category is the works whose purpose is to say what certain people think. Things like autobiographies, essays of opinion, scientific papers, which actually represent testimony, offers to buy and sell. Now, if you modify somebody else's work in this category, what you're doing is misrepresenting that person's views. That's not socially useful. So there's no reason why people should be free to publish modified versions of these works. And that means we could have a compromised copyright system where everybody is free to non-commercially redistribute exact copies of these works. However, to modify them or to distribute them commercially or use them commercially requires permission. This compromised copyright system would get rid of the nasty thing in today's copyright law. The thing that makes copyright law so nasty today is the fact that it restricts the general public so that it is not easy to enforce. It now requires invading everybody's home and computer. It's not uncontroversial, because it's not uncontroversial to sue teenagers for hundreds of thousands of dollars or put them in or their parents in prison. And it's no longer beneficial because the freedom we give up is too much. But this compromised copyright system gives us back the most essential part of the freedom, and that is the freedom to share. So that it turns copyright law back into an industrial regulation applied to publishers. So this compromised copyright system will generate a revenue stream more or less as the existing copyright system does, but without the nastiness of it. Well, that's the second category. What about the third category? Artistic and entertainment works, whose purpose is simply in what it feels like to look at or listen to the work. Well, it took me a long time to figure out a good position on modification of these works. And the reason is there are valid arguments on both sides. The argument against the modification is that some of these works have an artistic integrity, and modifying them can destroy that integrity. And I believe that's sometimes true, but not as often as the authors say, when you consider how ready they are to let Hollywood butcher their works in exchange for enough money. Most of them, that is. There are occasional exceptions. But then on the other side, for modified versions, we have to recognize that they can contribute to art. Consider, for instance, the folk process, by which a series of many people transforming a work can produce something rich and beautiful. But if we want to look at known named authors, consider Shakespeare. Many of Shakespeare's plays use stories taken from other plays that had been published a few decades before. And so, if today's copyright law had been in effect then, those plays of Shakespeare would have been illegal, and we would never have seen them or read them. And the copyright holders would have said, well, you're not missing anything. Those would have been cheap ripoffs. Why should anybody be able to make cheap ripoffs? Of course, since we have seen those plays, we say that some of them are among the masterworks of human literature. But we can only say that because we've seen them. We would be unable to judge for ourselves if we had never seen them. We would be unable to say that that copyright holder who says it's a cheap ripoff was wrong. So there are arguments on both sides about modifying these artistic works. But one thing is clear. It's not desperately urgent to make these modified versions. If you have an idea for how to make a different version of a play that might be interesting in its own way, it's good for you to be able to do that, but it can wait a while, like it can wait 10 years for the other play to go into the public domain. So we can use the same compromised copyright system where everybody is free to distribute exact copies non-commercially, but all modification and commercial use require permission, as now. And then eventually the copyright expires, and then people can make their modified versions as a further contribution to art. So this will produce a revenue stream, more or less as now, and thus we can expect these works will continue to be produced. Now, one consequence of this compromised copyright system is music sharing on the internet, in fact, sharing of any kind of published work, must be legal. Sharing is friendship. To attack sharing is to attack the bonds of society. The record companies want us to believe that this would be a disaster for musicians. It's nonsense. The fact is, the contracts that the record companies sign with musicians are so exploitative that nearly all the records in a record store give the musicians no money. When I buy a commercial CD, which I do from time to time, that's most of how I get, mostly how I get music, I feel ashamed because I'm not supporting the musicians. I know that they're going to get nothing. Now you might wonder, how could that be true? Isn't there a certain fraction that's supposed to go to the musicians? Well, theoretically there is. But the record contract says that the production and publicity expenses are treated as an advance to those musicians. So that fraction that supposedly is for the musicians actually is just put into a different account in the record company where it serves to repay, supposedly, part of this advance that the musicians didn't actually get. And very few records actually sell enough copies that they finish repaying these advances and actually give the musicians some money. Very, very few. Now, this doesn't mean that having a record contract is of no benefit to the musicians, because they do get the benefits of the publicity, which means they get more people coming to their concerts, and they probably get to do more concerts. So that's how they make money, and they probably can sell things at their concerts, and they make money from that too. So the publicity does do some good for them, but there's more than one way to give musicians publicity for their music. The current way, because it's driven by business money, operates on hype. And that's not healthy for music. So I think we should get rid of it. We'll be better off without it. Music will be better off without it. And instead, we can give musicians publicity by sending a copy of the music to friends. Say, here this is, listen to it, do you like it? It'll do the same job. And so the only musicians that will actually lose are the superstars. And they might actually lose something, but they'll be okay anyway. It's not going to be a disaster. So there's no problem if we legalize music sharing. But people might say, what about movies? Movies cost so much to make. Don't they need to put chains on us? Well, no, they don't, actually. First of all, more than half of the so-called production cost is actually publicity. If they did less advertising, then they could do with half the money. Now, keep in mind that a lot of the uses of movies are commercial uses, and under this compromised copyright system, those commercial uses would have to pay just as they do now. So I think they'd get half, or maybe even more. And also note that these figures, aside from including publicity, they are padded as a way of keeping the money in the studio for the studio executives instead of paying it out to investors. They're doing creative accounting. And of course, they always would have the possibility, instead of focusing on extremely expensive special effects, they could make movies about interesting and intelligent stories about people doing things with each other. They really could if they were determined to. It's no accident that most of what Hollywood makes is crap. And it's not because they're all incompetent either. It's not incompetence, it's the system that has this result. The system is such that it can only make crap. It won't let anything else be done. So if it disappeared, I wouldn't see that it had been any great loss. Now, I'm not saying we should censor it. I mean, if people want to make crap, I'm not saying they shouldn't be allowed to. But that's not the question. The question is this systematic production of crap so sacred that it justifies taking away our freedom? And I think the answer is no. So I don't think we have any disaster to fear if we simply legalize the sharing of the non-commercial sharing of exact copies of published works. But we might want to do a better job of supporting the arts than the current system. The current system works pretty badly. Maybe we would like one that works well. So I have a couple of proposals for how to do better. One is through a system of taxes. If you tax something related to use of the internet or computers in some way, doesn't matter what it is, and then you hand out the money to artists of whatever kinds based on their popularity as measured by some kind of polls or surveys, but not in linear proportion. And the reason is a superstar can easily be 1,000 times as popular as an ordinary successful artist. But it's not efficient use of our tax money to give the superstar 1,000 times the share that the ordinary successful artist gets. So I suggest using a function that tapers off so that the superstar will get more, but not 1,000 times more, maybe 10 times more or 5 times more. Well, if we avoid giving most of the tax money to superstars, a much larger fraction of it is available for the artists of a moderate success level, those who are good but not so tremendously lucky, say. And that means the same amount of tax money can support more of these artists at the level where they don't have to have day jobs. And that is, after all, the point. So I think if we consider, say, music, I think a system like this would be perhaps 100 times more efficient than the current one. The reason is that, from what I've read, the major record companies pay 4% of their revenue to musicians. And of course, most of that goes to superstars. It's really not very much to everybody else. Well, suppose it's another 5% for composers. Well, that's 10%. Well, if we didn't collect the money to keep that company going, if we just needed 10%, that's 10 times more efficient. But then, because of the non-linearity, we don't need to make the money so much that we make the superstars rich just to get enough for the artists of ordinary success levels. We could do with only a tenth as much, and we'd still do an adequate job of supporting these and those. So that's why I'm estimating maybe 100 times more efficient. If we were willing to have this tax amount to 1/10 of what people spend now on recorded music, we might do 10 times better at supporting artists. Well, this is one proposal. But the other proposal is not based on taxes. It's based on voluntary payments. Imagine that each player has a button you can push to send $1 or 1 euro or whatever, you know, 8 kroner or 10 kroner, whatever. Something in that approximate range. That is, it's not really tiny, but it's small enough that most of you would not hesitate, because it's small enough you wouldn't miss it. Of course, there are some poor people, even in Europe or the US, who really couldn't afford to send a dollar. But that's okay. The artists don't need to squeeze blood out of those poor people. There are enough people who are not poor, who can perfectly well afford to push this button every month, or even every week, or maybe even every day. And if this didn't send enough money, then we could encourage people with a friendly, kind public relations campaign. Instead of telling people, you're thieves because you shared with somebody, we could tell them, have you sent a dollar to your favorite band this month? Why not? It's such a small amount of money, and don't you love the music? For the case of music, I have an estimate for how much money we need. I read a few years ago that the average American spent about $20 a year for music. And if 4% goes to musicians and another 5% or so goes to composers, that would be $2 a year per person on the average. So if people push the button twice a year on the average, that would support them as well as the current system does. I think we could get that up to more than 2 times a year on the average. I think this system would work a lot better than the current system. So now I'm done, and it's time for questions.
I think you should also mention something about the pirate pocket.
Oh, right, okay. Well, my proposals are not exactly the same as those of the Pirate Party. But for the most part, I'd be happy to go along with their platform. Except for one thing, they made a mistake. Their platform has a bad consequence in the case of software that they probably didn't notice. What they've proposed is that all published works would go into the public domain after 5 years. So if a free software package is published, say, under the GNU GPL, then after 5 years, its source code would go into the public domain. And that means people could take that source code and put it into proprietary programs. Well, that's not really a good thing, but it would be okay if we could do vice versa. If after 5 years we could take the code of proprietary programs and put them into free software. If it worked both ways, then I could say yes to this deal. But it doesn't work both ways, and the reason is that typically with proprietary programs, they only release an executable. So after 5 years, the executable is in the public domain, but we can't get the source code ever. So it's one-sided. The source code of free software can get incorporated into proprietary software after 5 years, and the source code of proprietary software never can get put into free software because it's never published. And not only that, this executable that supposedly is in the public domain, or that officially is in the public domain, might well never work at all. It might have a time bomb in it. It might have some code in there that says, after a certain date, I'm not going to run. I'll just stop. And that date would be the date that it goes into the public domain. So even the people who already have copies when those copies go into the public domain, what they'll find is that they don't even work. This is what you get unless you do something to solve this problem. Now, you don't have to throw away their whole platform. You just have to fix this problem. And the way you do it is to say, if you want to distribute a program commercially or in connection somehow with commercial use, then you must put a copy of the source code in a depository library, which will release it into the public domain 5 years later. That solves the problem. So that's what I'm asking them to change in their platform. If they do this, they'll fix the problem, and I could support their platform. Now, I'd like to mention a few websites for you to look at. If you're interested in information about the free software movement and the GNU operating system, take a look at GNU.org. And if you want information about the Free Software Foundation, look at fsf.org. If you want information about FSF Europe, look at fsfeurope.org. We also have a campaign of protests against digital restrictions management at defectivebydesign.org, because that's what it means to implement digital restrictions management. It means it's designed not to work right. We have had people protesting in front of Microsoft events. We've had them protesting in front of Apple stores. We're going to have people protesting in front of movie theaters. And you know, we've got, well, a few months ago, we had 17,000 people signed up. By now, I'm sure we've got thousands more, but we need you as well. We are starting to make the people who want to chain us with DRM, we're starting to put them on the defensive. Just recently, one of them said, I don't want to talk about DRM anymore. Let's call it digital consumer enablement. Well, if they start using that term, we'll call it something like digital chains for entertainment. Because what they see, the argument they want to use is to say, we'll never let you have this at all unless you agree to the chains. So you see, really, we're doing you a favor by offering you chains. This is an argument we must reject. So sign up at defectivebydesign.org.
What about GNU priority projects? We in GNASH, we need more people.
We have it up there.
Yeah, it's 6 projects, I think.
I don't remember what the others are, but
BIOS, a free,
but you can see this on GNU.org.
Yeah.
If you're a programmer and you want to contribute by programming, then you know you can go to GNU.org and you can go to savannah.gnu.org and see the task list. But programming is not the only thing that the free software movement needs, or that the movement for the freedom to share other kinds of culture needs. It needs political organizing too. That's why you should go to defectivebydesign.org. Needs people to set up groups where people will work together. So it needs organizing. It needs carrying signs. It needs making handouts. It needs writing manuals. All sorts of different things.
I was just going to ask, for the first part, isn't the music industry very congruent to the dairy?
To the what?
Milk industry.
What? I can't understand the words you said. I can't hear you.
Sorry, my pronunciation sucks.
I'm half deaf. You have to speak loud and clear.
And I'm from Sweden. What can I say? What I said was, I just mused about the music industry being quite congruent to the milk industry. You have one major operator which takes care of the distribution of whatever product.
Well, actually, I think they have four instead of one. But that's almost the same kind of thing. When you have just four big companies competing, it's not too different from having a monopoly. But what's really important is you can copy recorded music and you can't copy milk.
True. No, I just mean that they pay near to nothing to the farmer.
Yeah.
Well, that's what happens when you have big companies in positions of power.
But the central issue was that the problem I have very bad eyesight. I have quite a lot of problems using things. I can't use Microsoft Windows, God no. And I got to know that the only thing I could get help with was Microsoft Windows because of a decision by the handicap blah 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 committee. Anyway, all of these regulations imposed by organizations basing their impact upon financial power in the end lead to marginalized groups being disregarded. And in the end, Microsoft fighting against Linux on computers.
Oh, but it's not Linux. Remember, I started this operating system and its name is GNU.
Yeah.
Linux is one component that's used with GNU. So please call it GNU plus Linux. But yeah, you're basically right.
I'm not referring to you as Linux, but I'm just saying that with Microsoft, for example, fighting against free software, with American publishing companies fighting to make books in... what's it called? Shit. Unavailable in any other form but the printed word, etc. The printed word, which is impossible for me to use. In the end, lead to the fact that I sit there and have a lot of products I can't use.
Yeah.
So that's just another dimension of it. And one question. Isn't it possible that the first category, a work in the first category you mentioned, can be transformed into work of the second category?
Well, maybe it could, but it's not a very useful thing to do. If you want to state your opinion, basically you're just going to have to write some text from scratch.
Yeah, I mean, this is elementary algebra, blah, blah, blah. By the way, I don't like badges. This is a...
You could, but, you know, basically a court would look at the work overall and say, what is this work really for? If it's mainly an algebra textbook and has a few notes stating your opinions in it, they'll say, this is a work of practical use. And if you really want to publish your opinions and have them treated as a work of opinion, you shouldn't mix it in with an algebra textbook.
Yeah.
Maybe we should let in some other questions. Other?
Well, if we should say that I create my own rootkit, wouldn't I be able to compile it in some free software project?
You can use a compiler to compile programs for anything at all. So I guess I don't get the point of the question.
Yeah, well, isn't it a problem that, for example, if I create my own rootkit, that I can compile it into any free software since the source code is available?
I don't understand. If you're saying you wrote some malicious program, and right? So you have the source code because you wrote it, I presume, right?
And yeah.
So you're saying, is it a bad thing that you can compile a program you wrote?
No, I don't think it's a bad thing. But isn't it a problem that someone could use it as a
use
way of...
Use what? You mean use, for instance, a compiler?
No, use a compiler in order to... No, I mean... I think it's good that you have the... What do you say? Opportunity.
Is, in order for me to understand you, I need you to stop using so many pronouns and start identifying specific things you're talking about. You say, isn't it bad that they could use it? But what is the it you are referring to? I don't understand. I can't see a coherent scenario here. There may be one, but you haven't pointed out what it is.
Yeah, well, isn't it for example, a security... What do you say? Not failure, but insecurity that you can compile, that you can use your rootkit and compile it into a free software.
I don't know what they mean by compile it into a free software. That's not meaningful at all.
To contribute to the free software.
Oh, you mean you could contribute? You could send to a developer some malicious code and suggest that he install it?
No, but... No. Since it's a
I don't understand the scenario you are thinking of. You've got to have a clear description of the scenario in order for us to have any opinion about it.
Yeah. Well, I don't exactly know how to put this, since I
think that there isn't really any scenario. I think that the reason it looks to you as if there were a problem, but there isn't a problem, and the apparent problem resides in the vagueness of the scenario. That any specific scenario, if you look at it, you'll see that there is no such problem.
Yeah, well, that pretty much answers my question.
You mentioned that you sometimes buy music. What artists do you usually listen to?
I listen to, well, for the most part, I listen to music of various genres that are not particularly popular in Europe or the US. But there are a few groups that I've liked that you might have heard of, such as, for instance, Fjällfolket, and Garmerna, and Vertina, and to name some from near here that you might have heard of.
Never have, sorry. But thank you for the answer.
Oh, I also have a few records by Hedningarna, which I like.
I had a question about the statements of opinion and the copyright time. When you suggested that there should not be allowed to redistribute modified works of someone's opinion, what would that do when the copyright expires after 10 years and they fall into public domain?
Well, that's an interesting question. Maybe that in that one case, that one limit should last longer. So maybe after 10 years, people could commercially republish it, but they couldn't modify it. I'm not sure.
Because that comes also for selective quoting and quoting someone out of
well,
context.
Well, quoting is different from making a modified work. Of
yes.
course, you need to be able to quote parts of other works.
Okay, that was all.
Where do you see FSF 10 years from now?
I can't see the future. My crystal ball is full of clouds.
What do you think? What do you imagine will happen with FSF?
I have no idea. 10 years ago, I would never have imagined anything like what's happening today. So I know I can't imagine what will happen in 10 years. Maybe you can, but I can't.
I have a question here. Like 20 years ago, you started the FSF and tried to, and actually quite succeeded, I must say, increase people's freedom by fighting for free software. And now you've get involved with the fighting digital rights management.
Digital restrictions management.
Yeah, sorry. Anyway, there
see,
is...
There are two ways, these are two different terms, and each one expresses, each one takes a side. If you call it digital rights management, you're supporting the entertainment companies trying to restrict us. And if you call it digital restrictions management, you're supporting the citizens that they want to restrict. So unfortunately, you've got to take a side.
Okay, but the question is, there is, and there are many other ways that people's freedoms are restricted. And one of them, is, of course, is to use secret file formats and protocols. And
yep.
Right now, there's a big fight going on, especially about free file formats, and the open documents, of course, is very important. Yet, I don't see the FSF getting involved in that.
Well, the reason is that there are a lot of others doing it, and it's not clear we could help very much. We were trying to do something not, you know, privately in Massachusetts when Massachusetts wanted to do it. But for the most, you know, we don't have anywhere near as much influence with governments as the companies that are lobbying for open document format. So they don't need our help in that. We would have to work very hard, and we would add a tiny bit to what they can do. But we're definitely in favor of that. But please note, the only way that non-free formats get used is through non-free software. So of course we're against it.
Right.
We're against all non-free software, and therefore, so for instance, we just started a campaign urging people to switch to Ogg Vorbis format for making audio, and Ogg Theora for video.
Right. I have a question about your two objections you have to the Pirate Party program. First of all, one of your objections is that, one of your sub objections is that the imbalance between proprietary software copyright expiring and the free software copyright expiring. Leads to an imbalance. For example, you put up the scenarios of time bombs here, but the Pirate Party program already includes a blanket. We want to outlaw DRM technology.
But I'm not talking about just DRM.
Well, a time bomb is a DRM technology inherently. It would be
well, okay, it's not usually called that, but in fact. Time bombs existed even in the 80s when nobody was thinking about DRM in the sense of restricting access to published works. But okay, if you prohibit time bombs, then there won't be time bombs. But unless you make the source code be available when the program goes into the public domain, it's not adequate.
Well, there's another point as well. I mean, source code, it's a lot easier to modify software with a soft code.
Oh, come on. Oh, boy. So you're going to make it really easy for the proprietary software developers to use the free software source code whose copyright is expired. But for us poor free software developers, you think we're going to have to do it the hard way. Well, thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much. But
fix the problem, and you'll have a good platform.
Binary code is reused all the time. Take a look at some of the objectionable wireless drivers there are for I'll say Linux here because it is actually for the Linux platform that are available. I'm sure they're objectional to you because they contain binary blobs.
I'm sorry, who, what? I couldn't understand. Objection, who, what?
Objectionable. You've got these binary blob wireless chip drivers.
Yeah, it's a problem.
But that in fact shows that some binary software can be reused.
It's, what do you mean? That's not a solution. It's not free software.
Well, it
can't be used in free software because it isn't free.
Well, it isn't. But the fact is that there's a difference between an ideal and...
You're just trying to just... You've made a pointless decision that leads to a problem, and now you're just trying to justify it instead of making the platform good. And you're trying to do it by citing a very unusual example that isn't adequate anyway. So in a few special cases, there's a non-free program that can be used with free software to some practical effect. It's not good, it's not ethical, but it works in a certain way. But you can run this non-free program, but that doesn't get you free software. So the argument you're making doesn't refute my point.
Well, in that case, it just shows we have different views on the matter. Free software is one ideal, sure, but copyright reform is...
Right, well, why don't you change this little detail of your copyright reform? You picked a way of doing it that has a bad byproduct in one area, but you can fix that. Why cling to it and insist on having this problem when you could fix it?
Well, because then we have to define what software is.
Actually, no, you don't. It's actually not very hard. The GPL has a definition of source code, and if it were used for other kinds of works, it would get you reasonable results too. And I don't think defining software is very hard because the law already has a definition of what's software.
Well, not in the scheme of copyright, because copyright itself doesn't really differentiate.
That's all right, but there are other areas of law which do differentiate between software and other things. I don't know if that's true in Sweden, but in other places it does. It's not that hard. You could even just leave it up to judges to say, you could give a sort of rough cut definition and say, judges will decide exactly where to draw the line. That's fine.
Well, I think we'll have to agree to disagree for the moment. Thank you very much for your time.
Hello, I have a question here. You mentioned the, this is where I am. You mentioned the bands that would receive $1 or $2. Today, if I want to receive money from people over the internet from various countries, I almost only have PayPal to turn to. What sort of development do you see in different kinds of payment solutions and what are their implications for freedom?
Well, I'm not an expert on that area technically. I do know that such systems exist, but they're not implemented socially. This is not a technical problem. It's not as if no technical discovery is needed to figure out how to do this. It's a social challenge, not a computer science challenge. And I don't know how to solve it. Because the reason we can give a coin to a street musician is that we've got coins for other purposes. Right. So we walk past a street musician and we've got some coins, we can give her some. So if we had some kind of anonymous digital cash system, then we could use it to send money to musicians too.
But this is something we've been waiting for to happen for 10 or 15 years. But
well,
do you expect it to happen or
do
you see
know.
Any start of it?
I don't know. The thing is to say expecting. I think that it probably will be necessary for there to be some government initiative. Mm-hmm. After all, if I'm talking about a change in laws, so which can't be done by private activity alone anyway. So once the government's getting involved in this question, it can set up some scheme. Remember, it's not a matter of making discoveries of new algorithms. It's a matter of setting things up.
Absolutely. But you have ideas about taxes and almost everything here, so I thought you had an idea.
No, I'm not an expert on anonymous payment systems.
Thank you.
I just know that there are some. David Chaum had an idea for digital cash, which he was very foolish and patented in the late 80s, which means that in a few years the patent may expire and maybe we'll be able to use it. But I'm told that there are other methods as well.
I have a question regarding software patents. Today, as a developer or programmer of free software, it's practically you can't avoid them. What could we do against
this?
Well,
first of all, any software developer can avoid software patents. The nature of software patents is, if you allow software ideas to be patented such that a software developer can get sued for implementing those ideas, then if you develop a complicated program that combines lots of ideas, you're surely infringing lots of patents, and you might get sued. And the only solution is don't allow software patents. Anything else is just a palliative. It's like having mines in the streets, you know. You want to solve it, you got to get rid of the mines. Fortunately, this kind of mine, at least a government could just legislate that they don't exist anymore. You don't have to find them one by one and get rid of them.
Yes, thank you. I have another question about trusted platform computing.
You mean treacherous computing.
The platform computing, yes. Microsoft, for example, talks a lot. It should be the only way to access your banks and so on. And I feel like companies like Microsoft and Intel are growing too much power.
Well, for sure.
What could we do to oppose this?
Well, first of all, why do I call it treacherous computing and why do they call it trusted computing? Once again, it's a matter of whose side you're on. What does this actually do? It's designed, it's a plan to change the design of all computers, of all future computers, and it's been mostly implemented already. So the computers you get today are not real computers. What do I mean by that? A computer is a universal programmable machine, a machine you could program to do anything, to do any computation. Well, the whole point of treacherous computing is that shouldn't be true anymore, that there should be things you can't program the computer to do, that it can't be programmed to do. Specifically, they want a website to be able to verify that you are running the officially approved unmodified software. So if you modify anything, then the website will know that you've modified something and it will refuse to talk to you at all. So imagine then you wanted to talk to your bank, but your bank says, I won't even talk to your machine unless you're running the official unmodified Windows system. That's what they want to make possible. And the idea is they want it to be impossible for us to program free software to talk to the bank the same way. Now, why should the bank care? It's stupid, right? There are banks that do online banking now, and you can talk to them with any web browser. You can talk, as long as it has SSL capabilities. And so people use free software and they do their banking. But of course, Microsoft wishes that these banks would refuse to talk to you unless you're running Windows. And there are some banks whose websites will only work with Windows, although not for this reason. And there's a campaign in China to try to pressure one of the big banks in China to allow their website to work with free software. But in any case, they call it trusted computing because they want to be able to trust your computer to obey them instead of you. This is why, from your point of view, it's treacherous computing. So how do we fight against it? It's not easy. But just by running free software, just by saying, I'm using GNU/Linux, if you want me as a customer, you better make your site talk to me, we are pressing back.
Okay, hi. First, thanks for an interesting lecture. And secondly, my question, do you encourage people to break the law if it favors freedom as you just defined it?
Laws that oppress people have no moral authority, so breaking them is not wrong. And if a law tells you to mistreat other people, then breaking it and treating other people well is admirable. Laws are human institutions. They're set up by governments. Now, these governments might be democratic, or they might obey the rich. Which one is more common today? So they have to earn moral authority, just like anything else people do. And if these governments are obeying the rich, then they're not earning much moral authority. There are certainly plenty of situations in which your duty is to refuse to cooperate with the police. You can't, if you're trying to be a good person, you have to wonder, anytime the police want your cooperation, you have to wonder, are they trying to do good or trying to do evil? Maybe they're trying to catch a murderer. Maybe they're trying to catch somebody who is suspected of having the wrong political beliefs so that they can put him in a plane for the CIA to take him to Syria or Egypt or Tunisia and have him tortured. Maybe they're trying to put him in prison because he shared with his neighbors. We have to get rid of the idea that the state deserves our support just because it's the state. If it wants to deserve our support, it better act in a way that deserves our support.
Thank you.
Oh, and I should point out that the European Union is extremely non-democratic. And the proposed constitution was even worse.
Hello.
So, although I think that the European Union provides many benefits in many areas, but a government so undemocratic has to be replaced.
You were referring to moral before, so I wonder if you believe in an absolute moral or.
Yes, although I don't say that anyone can know with certainty what they are. But I don't believe in moral relativism. I don't believe that that all points of view are equally valid and acceptable. Even though I can't necessarily be right. Right? I could have an idea and others can argue that I'm wrong. But I will not accept the idea that our condemnation of torture is merely our cultural background or our opinion, and if Bush has a different cultural background, that his is just as legitimate as ours.
I have a question. On your category two of category two of personal opinion, do you really need copyright to hinder people from misrepresenting others?
I don't know. I mean, maybe. I don't. It's too open-ended a question, and I don't know.
I think it touches on things like you said before. taking other things and mixing them up with copyright. I don't think personal opinion has any benefit from being ruled by copyright, really.
Well, in some sense, whatever it might be, does it matter if it has the same effect?
Since you're proposing special rules for personal opinion copyright.
I guess I don't understand. Are you saying, well, let's just not call it copyright because it's something special?
No, why legalize it, have laws about it at all? If someone misrepresents someone else's view, people will notice that.
Not necessarily. I have to tell you, most articles about me misrepresent my work. They say that I support open source.
Should that be illegal, you mean?
No, but I'm just pointing, I mean, it's after all, that's their opinion, not mine. But the point is that most people don't know this is wrong.
Well, sure.
So I think you're being too optimistic, thinking that that if people are being misquoted, that everyone will find out.
I'm not being optimistic. I know it's a problem. I can see it's a problem, but I don't think you can legalize away that problem.
Well, I'm not sure of that.
Okay, thank you.
By the way, I'll take two more questions because it's getting late.
Okay. The first question then. You speculated before that it made it necessary to allow any copying of workable software that you use for productivity, since if you were allowed to modify it, it was difficult to distinguish between what was modified and what was not.
Not exactly. What I'm saying is it's that modifications can be small. So if you allow people to publish modified versions, there's just no point stopping them from republishing unmodified copies.
Okay, so couldn't you just restrict it to allowing people to publicize the changes, the explicit changes, and keep?
That's not convenient. I mean, you need to be able to distribute. You need to use the combined version.
Okay, thank you.
Check. Okay, up here. I got two questions.
Well, I'll answer the first one.
Okay, I was just wondering, if I took a software that was under the GPL license and compiled it, encrypted it, and released it as a proprietary software, as a commercial software.
Well, commercial is irrelevant, but because you know the GPL in almost everything makes no distinction between commercial or non-commercial. But suppose you're going to make it a proprietary program. Continue.
Yes. If I was making a proprietary program and selling it, is there some way for you to detect that this is a software that is under the GPL license?
Well, first of all, it doesn't matter whether you're selling it or not. That's just a detail. If you were giving away copies, it would be just as much of a violation, because the whole point of the GPL is that you've got to respect the freedom of those that you give the copies to, whether you're giving them or selling them. That's just a detail.
Yeah,
but in any case, so your question is there some guaranteed way we could always tell? And the answer is no. But we think that we'll usually find out.
Yes, but do you think that Microsoft business is using any software under the GPL license?
Well, illegal. We know Sony did. And in fact, we find out lots of cases of violations, and we go to them and we say, you have to stop this, you have to clean this up, and they do. But major companies generally don't want to be violating the GPL. In fact, more and more they're trying to set up internal systems to make sure they don't. I mean, you might think that they're just thinking, oh, we've got this code, we're going to use it, we don't care about this license. No. They really are worried. They don't want to be breaking the law this way.
Okay, thanks. And the second question was...
Well, I'm really tired. It's been a long time. And I want to remind people that there are stickers to give away, and there are pins and key rings for sale, that you can use these cards to become a member of. That you can. You can use these cards to join FSF, and you can use fsfeurope.org to join FSF Europe.
Yeah, and as a token of our appreciation for your great speech, Lisa Otter and Digitree would like to hand over this.
Thank you.